Our next presenter is David Agnew. David's a channel manager of Intraplex products with Gates Air in Mason, Ohio, responsible for management of Intraplex product distribution channels in North America. David has 30 years of experience in AM and FM broadcast engineering, including stints with Harris Corporation and iHeartRadio in Lincoln, Nebraska and Northern Colorado markets. Mr. Agnew has been an SBE member and certified professional broadcast engineer. He holds an AAS degree in electronics engineering and continued education in mathematics and computer science. Welcome, David.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks to Linda for doing a great show every year and the association for having me. So, what I'd like to talk about today is composite STL. It's kind of the new old, right? Okay, so there's something new about the old. And there's kind of some benefits that we have with doing composite audio. And the ability to do it over IP is kind of interesting. So, and there's been some new developments. I think I gotta hold this for a second. There we go. So when I put this presentation together, I thought it'd be kind of interesting to look at the STL topology as it's sort of morphed over the years, and how it's impacted the audio chain more than anything. So the point of looking at this is just to see, you know, what the STL has done to the audio chain and the components within the audio processing chain and stereo generation. We'll take a look at the composite audio components, just the basic analog components, and we'll review the digital composite standard AES 192. One of the neatest things is we'll look at the new data rates for FM composite audio and how we can transport that more reliably over an IP connection, and because they've come down quite a bit. And we'll look at the reliability and the security of doing this over IP. How do we do it reliably? How do we do it securely? And then I'll show you a couple of applications. So back in the day, we had equalized telephone lines. It was a common STL, right? And we used discrete processors, limiters, AGCs, five or six different pieces of audio processing, separate pieces of audio processing gear, including the stereo generator and SCA generators, which I highlighted here. So we had a lot of audio processing gear. And I highlighted the stereo generator because it's kind of moved around over the years as we've made changes to STLs. We also had discrete left and right. You know, Marty had discrete left and right STLs in the 950 band. Not a whole lot changed when that came about. There was a big change when we went to analog composite. That was kind of nice because it moved the audio processor and SCA generators and things back to the studio. And at that about that same time, the audio processor manufacturers, Orban and Omnia, started to consolidate all these individual pieces into a single box. We still had, Orban had a studio chassis and a transmitter, FM stereo generator, so we had some division of the processing during this time, but this was kind of a nice thing because we got the equipment back to the studio where we could manage it, control it, adjust it a lot easier than at the transmitter side. And we went along like that for quite a while. And I think around 1988, Mosley came out with a digital STL, which was a 950 digital STL using MPEG encoding. And that was neat. There was a lot of advancements there. Signal to noise improved, fade margins improved, but it did change the structure quite a bit. We had to move the FM processor back out to this transmitter site, and we're transporting left and right audio now. So that was the big change. And along about that same time, T1 STLs came along. And they were transporting left and right audio also, and that kept the stereo generator at the transmitter site. So at about that time, we started to see computer automation come into play. Computer automation started to use compression algorithms, we started to see a lot of fighting of these algorithms in the automation systems and in the STLs. And so one of the big developments back in the 90s, mid-90s maybe, was the uncompressed digital STL. And that was a big advancement, and that was a big improvement, but we still had left and right audio to deal with, and not much changed with regards to where equipment was located. And then HD radio came along, and we got a whole new bunch of pieces of gear to deal with. We got HD 2 and 3 processing. We've got to process the HD audio separately from the FM audio. We have to time align the two or offset them. We've got diversity delay to deal with. And so things got a lot more complicated at that point. And this is kind of where I'm getting to, is that composite tends to be a pretty good choice in a lot of cases because we can have a lot of this gear back at the studio. So that's sort of the point of this whole preview or review, I guess I should say. So what we're going to talk about primarily is not the bottom two black boxes, although I'm going to mention that at the end. It's the two single rack unit codecs that operate over IP. And they carry E2X data, and the E2X data is time locked, so the diversity delay won't change from the studio to the transmitter site, to the exciter. And we're able to transport an AES-192 signal, and we are able to transport analog composite. And we can do that cross-domain. So we can input an AES-192 signal, and we can come out. We always get out all three, AES-192, analog 1, and analog 2, no matter what we put in. So we have a lot of flexibility as far as what type of audio we feed the STL and what we get out and what we can put into the exciters that we have. So the composite signal hasn't changed much. It's a 20 hertz to 100 kilohertz signal. Stereo baseband is left and right. Audio is 30 to 15 or 17 kilohertz. We got a 19 kilohertz pilot, a 38 kilohertz subcarrier, and then we've got our SCAs, 57 kilohertz, 67, and 92. And with modulation, we're out to about 100 kilohertz. So this is the signal that we have to deal with when we're in a digital domain. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, there it went off. Okay. Sorry about that. The light was still green, so I don't know. Oh, wait. Did it come back? Okay, so we got the old analog composite, which it hasn't changed, although it has changed. It's there's a new digital standard. And we've got E2X data that we have to deal with. About 300 kilobits per second of UDP or TCP/IP that we need to transport from the studio to the transmitter site if we decide to put the exporter at the studio. So a few years back, a new standard was developed. AES-192 is what it's called. It's really AES-3 audio. It is AES-3 audio at 192 kilohertz sample rate. And it puts the entire composite signal, with the exception of a 92 kilohertz subcarrier, which modulates out to 100 kilohertz, it'll put the 57, the 67, and the baseband audio onto the left channel of the AES-3 audio format. Okay, and the bit rate, which is kind of what we're looking at, of AES-192 with a 24-bit word resolution is about 5 megabits per second. So that's what we've been tasked with transporting from studio to transmitter site, 5 megabits per second, and in the radio world, that's a pretty high bit rate. It won't pass over a 950 STL, and it can be difficult to pass over an IP connection depending on what type of service you have. And so this is probably the most important slide of the whole presentation, and this shows what we can do now with the data rate and how we can manage it and control it and configure it. And we do that via the sample rate, which we set based on the services that we want to transport. So if we want to just transport the baseband audio and a 57 kilohertz RDS subcarrier, we can set the sample rate down to 132 kilohertz, which impacts our data rate. We can also configure the bit resolution. We can change it from 12 bits to 24 bits. And that has a big impact on the data rate. So we can now get the data rate down for an uncompressed FM composite signal with a 57 kilohertz RDS subcarrier down to about 1.6 megabits per second. And if we add HD radio on top of that, we're at about 2 megabits per second. And that's uncompressed audio. There's no compression algorithms going on there. That's simply controlling the sample rate and the word resolution. Okay, so we have a lot of different types of networks that we can transport IP audio over, which is why being able to configure the data rate is important. We can do this over public internet, we can do it over business class public internet, different tiers of business class. We've got point-to-point private links, MPLS circuits. Those are a little bit more reliable, but they can be really expensive. And then we've got our private networks, which are our licensed and unlicensed gigahertz microwave radios. And I got to get a drink of water. So we have a lot of choices. Ethernet choices are becoming more prevalent. Older circuits, T1 circuits, going away. And so we need a way to utilize these Ethernet circuits reliably. Okay, so the challenges that we have are data rate, obviously, packet size, packet rate, all these things impact devices on the network. The transport protocol that we're using to send audio over IP is primarily RTP, embedded in UDP, which is a connectionless transport protocol. So we don't get a second chance to send packets. We're sending packets out, the transmitter is spitting them out and doesn't know where they're going. It's kind of like the US mail. We send it out, we don't know if the letter got there or not. So we need a way to make that signal more robust and mitigate errors that we see on networks. And the types of errors and things that we have to deal with are network jitter. Jitter in the network world is these packets don't arrive with the same latency or delay between each one of them, and so they're not ready for play out properly if they're not time aligned. They arrive out of order because they take different routes. We can have lost packets, and we can have different kinds of lost packets. We can have random packet loss, we can have burst packet loss, and we deal with those types of loss in different ways. And then we can just have network failures, or the network goes down because they're doing maintenance. So those are primarily the types of errors and things that we have to overcome. And we have a lot of tools to do that. So one of the first tools we use for jitter is a jitter buffer. And a jitter buffer is a configurable buffer. We can set it statically, or it can be a dynamic buffer. It can stretch and squeeze as needed within limits. Okay, we have to set limits on that dynamic jitter buffer. And what that does is it just brings the packets in, reorganizes them in the right order, puts them in time alignment, plays them out. If the jitter buffer is exceeded, the amount of jitter, we're going to start to lose packets. We're going to drop packets. And one of the techniques that we use to overcome dropped packets, random packets, okay, if we have random loss, we can deal with that pretty effectively using forward error correction. And this is an example of a matrix that we use for forward error correction. We define error correction in percent. So we can apply 25%, 50%, 75%, or 100% error correction. And what the percentage alludes to is the amount of overhead. So if we're applying 50% forward error correction, our payload is going to increase by 1.5 times. So if we have a megabit throughput and we apply 50% error correction, we're going to have 1.5 megabits of data to throughput. And this is pretty cool the way this works. So the 1 through 16 are the packets. We have rows and columns, and we XOR the rows together to come up with a set of parity packets. I'm going to try and use my little pointer here. So we have parity packets created for each row and for each column. This doesn't show up very well on the screen. And that's our overhead, okay? So this is a 4x4 matrix. We've got 16 packets of primary audio, and we've got 8 packets of parity packets, right? So we have 50% overhead. So at the receive end, we use these parity packets to reconstruct a packet that we lost. So if we lose packet two in row one, we can recover packet two by using the parity packets. So this is a pretty neat mechanism for recovering random losses primarily. We can also interleave that matrix. So we can take that matrix and we can interleave it. This is a really old correction scheme that's been around for a long time, but it does work. The original stream is at the top. We interleave it using an algorithm. Going across the network, we have a burst error at the receive end. We put it back together and we spread that burst error over the entire stream to create random errors, which the forward error correction can then fix. Okay, and we also have time and network diversity, and those are two really powerful error correction techniques as well. And I'm going to skip to the next slide because I've got a graphic that describes it pretty well. If you just focus on the top network one and these two streams, this is an example of time diversity. And what we do is we create two transmit streams that are identical, and we have obviously 100% overhead when we do that. We offset the two streams in time by some number of milliseconds. And at the decode end, we use those two streams to stitch back together a complete stream. And that can be done over a single network. We don't need two networks to do that. And it's very effective. You cannot hear it working. I've tested it. I've tried to make it glitch. It is absolutely seamless. It's amazing. And then the other way that we can use this technology is by using another network. So that's network diversity. So we're sending a second stream or even a third stream over a completely separate network. And so this protects us in the same way, protects us against a network outage, and makes the system much more robust. So, and you can combine these as well. You could do time diversity on network one, and you could do time diversity on network two. You can create four streams and have a lot of redundancy and robustness built into the system. And this type of error correction is directed mostly towards burst losses or network failure completely, obviously. So this slide I put in by accident. It's a concealment. It is a correction scheme that's used, but it's not used in the composite codecs because we can't conceal a complex signal like a baseband audio signal. So I'm just going to skip over that. Okay, the other thing that is important for reliable operation is understanding the network that we're running across. And having network analytics that can look at the network performance live, log that data, keep that data to analyze, set up email alerts. All these things are very important for understanding the type of network that we're operating across, how it's functioning initially. We can use this tool to log data into a file and then crunch that file, and the program will actually tell us what type of correction to employ. Because we have so many different types of correction, it's a great tool to tell us what type of correction to use. It's also a great tool to tell us when things have changed on the network. When we start adding all these error correction techniques, we can mask and cover up pretty significant errors. Obviously, if we have dual streams going across two networks, we can completely lose a network and not even know it. So this allows us to monitor the network, see if it's changed, see if anything has happened, even though we're still on the air. So it's a very powerful tool. Okay, and we can also monitor streams. Just look at one page and see every stream that we have in the network, how it's functioning. Because we can have multiple streams, they can be main, backup, tertiary streams. Maybe one goes down, we want to know about it. Okay, so network security is another big thing with these codecs, right? We're not going to put our main signal on the public internet unless we have some security. So these codecs need multiple network interface controllers so that we can segregate traffic from internal WAN to a public network. We need firewalls on every NIC. We need access control lists. We need to be able to turn protocols on and off on every port. This is a big security thing. We can shut off every protocol that's on that port with the exception of RTP. We need web access protection. We need, obviously, account credentials, passwords. We need to protect against dictionary attacks. So secret questions, if you miss the password three times, is important. Excuse me. We need secure web access. Stream security is important. We can identify a stream with a PIN on the transmit side, and we identify it on the receive end. If the pins don't match, the audio doesn't play out. If we manage these devices with SNMP, we need to use a secure version of SNMP. SNMP version 3 is the one we want to look for. It uses authentication and it uses encryption. So all these things are important. Switch. Okay, so we have a lot of tools available to provide reliable transport of our signal, and now composite audio. We've got configurable data rates. We've got dynamic and static jitter buffering, forward error correction, packet interleaving, not concealment, stream splicing, network analytics, and network security. All these things together make for a package that will provide the reliability that we're looking for in an STL. Okay, so this is a diagram of what I was getting at in the very beginning of why composite audio could be a good thing at your station, and why I kind of think it's a good thing. It gets all these devices, importer, exporter, audio processor, SCA generators, all back to the studio site where we can manage them much more effectively, easier. We can pass E2X data across this STL, time-locked, diversity delay is time-locked. We can use a single audio processor for FM. We can use that processor for the main channel, the HD channel, in-house processing, et cetera. So we only need one audio processor to deal with, which is a big thing. So the other thing that we can do, now that we have the data rates down to 1.6 megabits per second, is we can pass this signal across a 950 STL that's capable of passing that much data. So any STL that can do 2 to 3 megabits per second can pass the IP signal from the composite STL. So not only can we do it across a network, we can do it across a 950, and that gives us the option of having a main and a backup. So we're going to have a composite STL as our main, the IP connection as backup. And this is just a graph that shows the data rates that we can do generally across a 950 system, the gray blocks. The services and the data rates associated and the bits, the bit resolution that we choose. The graph over on the right shows the maximum data rate in a 500 kilohertz STL channel at different QAM rates. So at 32 QAM in a 500 kilohertz channel, we can do 2 megabits per second up to 3.2 megabits per second at 256. The other place that this composite STL is very beneficial is in single frequency networks, and we heard a little bit about that in the last talk. This is very beneficial. If we can create the baseband signal, one baseband signal, and transport that baseband signal out to multiple exciters, it improves the performance of single frequency networks significantly. It makes them a lot less complex to adjust and maintain and improves the performance. So that's another area. And then we can also multicast. So this could be a graphic of multicasting one signal to a main site, another signal to an auxiliary site. So in summary, we've got lower data rates that enable composite over IP and 950. Composite STL brings all of our critical FM and HD hardware back to the studio where it's easily managed and maintained. Single processor, et cetera. Our on-air processor can be used for everything, main FM, HD, in-house processing. It becomes much more efficient. Single frequency network, multicasting, we talked about that. These STLs interoperate. They'll accept an analog composite signal, a digital. They'll output all three. So we can provide whatever we want on the input, and we get everything out on the output. We have a lot of powerful correction tools to transport this signal over IP and an STL. And we can transport HD radio E2X stream with the diversity delay lockdown. And that's Ethernet port to Ethernet port. So in E2X from the exporter to one of the three ports out to XGen in the exciter. We have secure operation capabilities now. And we can do simultaneous. With multi-streams, we can do simultaneous operation over 950 and an IP connection, which gives us a lot of flexibility. And that is all I have. I appreciate your time. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. OK, thanks.